You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. Yesterday, the latest House immigration bill brought to a vote by Paul Ryan went down by a vote of 112 to 300. Now, this had been promoted as an alternative to an effort by some GOP lawmakers to get relief for Dreamers by bringing legislation straight to the floor through a procedure called a discharge petition. That would be an end run around the House leadership and would probably involve passing a bill with more Democratic support than Republican support. We're joined now by one of the Republican lawmakers who was willing to do it. Jeff Denham represents California's 10th congressional district, that is the city of Modesto and its environs. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
What's next? Are you back to the discharge petition?
I think timing is a challenge to do another discharge petition. We're looking at every other option to force a vote on this. But ultimately, this crisis is not going away. In fact, with court decisions coming up, we expect it to only get worse. Congress has to do its job, and we need to find a fix.
I mean, clearly, there's a political obstacle inside your caucus, which is that you can't get everybody to agree on something they can pass without Democratic support. And the leadership doesn't want to bring something to a vote that won't pass with majority Republican support. What alternatives do you have procedurally other than a discharge petition?
Well, I believe that this was really an opportunity to show the entire country that bipartisanship is something that should be considered not only by the House, but by the country. We need to pass a bipartisan bill. Both Republicans and Democrats have failed to pass bills either in a mixed government or when one party has control of both houses and the presidency. This bill that we took up now shows that a majority of Republicans can support a pathway to citizenship for our nation's dreamers. And Democrats have also supported border security in the past. So I believe we're going to have to pull together a very narrow bill that addresses those two pillars of border security and a fix for Dreamers.
A lot of Democrats do object to funding that wall on the border. Why not just bring a simple standalone petition that says Dreamers get relief from the threat of deportation and a path to citizenship? Let it go up or down on its own merits.
Yeah, certainly it's disappointing to see that some Democrats now won't support border security.
They're called a discharge petition. That would be an end.
But it is something that Democrats should support. And now we've got Republicans on record supporting a fix for Dreamers as well. It's going to take both parties coming together and resolving those two issues.
What's next? Are you back to the discharge petition?
I think timing is a challenge to do another.
We're a couple years ago. Is there any reason other than a political one why taxpayers should shell out an extra $25 billion for the border?
I think it's important for any country to be able to protect its borders and make sure that they know who's coming across, what is coming across, and actually following the rule of law. There's no reason that we can't and shouldn't secure our border. I think the American public expects that. We're a nation of laws, and securing our border is one of those ways to protect those laws.
What about the possibility of a standalone bill to address the question of parent-child separation at the border?
Well, certainly that was part of this bill. We made an amendment to this to make sure that you kept kids together with their parents. And as a father, I would always fight to keep my kids with me and make sure that they were safe. And so there is going to need to be a legislative fix. It is something that I would support coming to the floor as soon as possible. But it certainly could be part of this overall fix for Dreamers as well.
But would you support addressing it quickly without attaching it to border money?
Yeah, I don't think that the issues need to be combined. Ultimately, we've got a crisis, and we can't afford to see any more kids separated from their parents. An immediate fix by Congress is something that should happen. And, you know, border security is something we can move forward as we look for a fix for Dreamers.
From your perch in Congress, what's keeping a swift vote on child-parent separation from happening?
I don't think there's any reason why Congress shouldn't do its job and bring that up immediately. That's the next most important bill that we got to bring up.
Jeff Denham, let's take the horse trading and the politics out of it for a second. If you had a magic wand and you were the only vote that counted for making laws, what would an ideal immigration bill look like at this point?
I think making sure that we not only provide certainty for our dreamers, but the entire 1.8 million dreamers should have certainty from day one with a pathway to citizenship. And we should also secure our border in that same process. Those are the two biggest issues. And I think all of the other issues, while we've got a broken immigration system, they can all be resolved in an immigration reform bill. But we've got to solve those two problems first.
What does securing the border mean to you? Do you think spend an extra $25 billion, you won't have anyone coming here without documents?
No, I think that we've got port of entries. You know, we are still going to address asylum at those port of entries. We will still have people that want to cross and try to cross during those port of entries. But we need to be able to give the American public a guarantee that we have both the technology. You know, if we can have technology on Afghanistan's border as our men and women are fighting in foreign lands, then we ought to be able to have the technology at our southern border to know who's coming across, when they're coming across, and what they're bringing across with them. There are certain areas that you need a physical barrier, just like we have in the south part of California along the San Diego border. We need to make sure that we've got security, both with physical fences, as well as making sure that our law enforcement, our border security, and ICE agents are protected as well.
But are you saying that spend $25 and unauthorized border crossings aren't going to happen?
No, I think that we've got to give a guarantee to the American public that, first of all, that we have security in every place that we can. But we also have mountains, cliffs, rivers. We're going to need to make sure that we've got technology barriers as well so that we know miles in, who's lining up, driving a car, preparing to cross, and ultimately able to address not only those that are coming across, but what they're bringing across with them.
I guess my question is, and this is a, you know, question for the taxpayer, like, my understanding is $25 billion is a down payment on what the Trump administration wants to do by border security. So if it's a down payment, what's the ultimate price tag? $100 billion? $200 billion? How much taxpayer money has to get spent before you can say the country has full control
billion.
Of its border?
17? $17 billion is what the president is requesting of the $25 billion. The additional $7.5 to $8 billion would be an increase in Border Patrol and ICE agents along our southern border. I do also think that we need to address the courts as well, making sure that we can address the backlog so that we have immediate due process along the southern border so that we're not detaining people for long periods of time. But the $17 billion would do the physical barrier in the places where you can put a physical barrier up. And we obviously have a lot of the technology already prepared to put along the southern border that would give the American public a guarantee, again, that we know who's coming across and what our apprehension rates are. You can't just have an open border.
Representative Denham, what are the needs in your district? You have a lot of big growers there. Many of them rely on immigrant labor. Are they expressing concern to you about the fact that fewer people are available to work?
We have a vibrant ag economy, which means we've got a lot of the fresh fruits and vegetables that not only feed the rest of the country, but many exports that go throughout the world. We need to make sure that we've got a strong and consistent workforce, making sure that we're employing as many Americans as possible. But every industrialized nation has a guest worker program that allows workers from other countries to prosper, have a great way of life, and be able to take and send money home to their home countries. A guest worker program is something that we need to continue to work to not only have an ongoing labor force, but one that we can grow in the future. That's not only with an H-2A program, but also addressing other types of visas as well, so that we have a legal workforce.
What growers have told us about the H-2A program is it's just too cumbersome for them. For low-wage farm work, they're not going to go hire someone abroad then come deal with the bureaucracy at home to prove that that person will not be taking a job away from an American.
I think that we can have multiple systems. An H-2A system is in place and working in certain areas today. But the whole reason that we looked at other visas, combining other visas, so that we make sure that we're addressing all aspects of labor. You know, we have many high-tech visas where we're training the best and brightest around the world. We don't want to send them to other countries to create jobs and create businesses. We want those businesses right here in the U.S. of A.
Yeah, but a tech company is going to be willing to pay some red tape costs for a $200,000 a year software engineering position that's year-round. It's a little bit different hiring someone for just the harvest.
No, but we also have a variety of crops that you can go from one crop to the next. That's why we need portability in this, to make sure that labor that does come in can go to multiple different areas of a state or in different areas of the country. But our ag industry is also changing quite a bit. We are employing technology is creating much higher paying jobs in the agriculture industry, not just driving tractors or forklifts, but also making sure that you're addressing everything from irrigation to harvesting.
Got it. Jeff Denham, so circling around back to the first question, you said the time frame was not looking good for a discharge petition on immigration issues. Does that mean you personally are giving up on doing it that way this session?
I'm looking at every opportunity through both working with the parliamentarian to find new opportunities to bring this up, as well as working with both parties to force a vote. The only challenge of the discharge petition is the timing puts you out in December, and we cannot wait until December to bring up a bill. We need to bring up a bill now.
All right. Jeff Denham, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You got it. Thank you.
Jeff Denham is a Republican in Congress. He represents California's 10th Congressional District. That's the city of Modesto and its environs. He's one of a handful of GOP lawmakers who made an attempt to get relief for Dreamers to the floor of the House through a procedure that represented an end run around the House leadership. They abandoned that to make way for the House leadership-approved bill that came up for a vote yesterday. That bill went down by a stunning defeat, 112 in favor, 300 opposed. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. And if you want to understand politics in America today, it helps to unplug from the outrage cycle on cable news and look at what the apparatus of government is actually doing. With Congress and the presidency under unified Republican control for the past year and a half, there has been only one major legislative accomplishment, and that has been a massive tax break, principally for corporations. We're living in a period when corporate power is ascendant, and a lot of activists and analysts would trace that back to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2010, which opened the floodgates for unlimited spending to influence elections. But our next guest traces that story back a lot further, actually to before the founding of America, to tell the story of a kind of shadow civil rights movement that has been pursued in the courts with little input or attention from the public, a movement to expand the rights and powers of corporations. Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA, just out with We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I have to start by asking, your first book was about guns and efforts to regulate them and efforts to establish a right to possess them in the courts. How did you switch from that to corporate law?
The Supreme Court had these decisions in 2010 when I was writing my last gun book, Citizens United, that said that corporations had the same right as individuals to spend their money on election ads. And then in 2014, the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case said corporations had religious liberty under a federal statute and granted the national chain of craft stores an exemption from a generally applicable law that required them to have birth control in employee health plans. And these questions just raised a really important question in my mind, which was, how did corporations come to win our most fundamental rights? And I wanted to look back, and what I found really surprised me that the story goes back a lot deeper than I had ever imagined.
So your first claim in the book is that from the beginning, the corporate form is kind of baked into the American economy and society, even before the ink is dry on the Constitution. You're talking about the corporations that were chartered to set up colonies.
Well, the corporation really had an important influence on early America and on the Constitution. In early America, we think about the Pilgrims as the embodiment of the American origin story. You know, they are fighting for religious liberty. But 13 years earlier, the first English colony is established on our shores in Jamestown. And it was a corporate affair, a business venture run by the Virginia Company of London, one of England's early joint stock corporations. And it was there to make money and make money especially for the king. And it was even called Jamestown because it was named after the king. It wasn't period people who were seeking to revolt or run away from the monarchy. And those early colonies were often governed by corporate charters because they were organized as corporations and run as corporations. And those corporate charters ended up shaping early American attitudes about government, because government was defined by this document that listed what the powers of the office holders were, what the rights of the residents and the shareholders and stakeholders were, and what the limits were on government power. And those things were all done as part of a corporate charter, but that idea of a written charter that limits government became a real part of the idea of the Constitution itself. So we owe the Constitution's writtenness in some ways to the old corporate charters of early America.
It was interesting to think of this as a contrast to the Europe that colonists were leaving, where most people are in still basically feudal social relationships and living under governments that are monarchies. In that context, whatever kind of democratic governance and accountability is baked into a corporate charter might seem like refreshing progress.
Indeed, and corporations did give people a measure of self-control. What corporations from their earliest days as organizations that were chartered by government, it gave that group of people a certain right to go do something, and they could govern themselves. And especially in America, that idea of self-government, which really was embodied in a reform adopted by the Jamestown Colony and the Virginia Company in the 19-teens, which was to have a representative assembly where the people who lived in the colony could come and govern themselves. That was considered one of the landmarks of the move towards democracy, and it was done by the Virginia Company as a way to make the investment more attractive, to attract more people to come to the colony at a time when it seemed that everyone who came died pretty quickly.
Yeah. So one of the points you make in this section of the book is that the U.S. Constitution is not just modeled on Greek and Republican forms of democratic governance. It's not just modeled on the proto-parliamentary system that exists in England at the time. It's modeled on these corporate charters.
Yeah, that's right. If you look back, and in the book I take Massachusetts Bay Company Charter of 1628, and I compare it to the Constitution, and there's a lot of similarities in these two documents in that they are both the governing documents for a society, for an area, and they both list out who the founding person is, who ordains and establishes this entity, this government. It sets forth the rules of how the government's to operate, how it's supposed to enact bylaws, and what roles and officers must be. There was a governor who was really the chief executive and had a duty to take care that the bylaws be faithfully executed, and a lot of the powers that we see in the presidency today. There was an assembly, similar to a Congress, a legislature that had the power to adopt self-governing rules for self-governance. And you had rights, individual rights that the stakeholders had. You know, in the 1620s, it was the right to fish that was guaranteed by corporate charters. But the right was, the rights were a little bit different by the time of the founding.
And fishing was a little bit more economically significant back then.
Indeed, and more necessary.
Yeah. So interestingly, although the corporate charter serves as an antecedent to the Constitution, there is no mention in the Constitution of any kind of status, prerogative, or right for corporations.
No, that's right. While the corporate form influenced what the framers did, they weren't thinking about it in those terms quite, and nor did they think about giving rights to corporations the way the Constitution was recognizing the rights of citizens and persons. There's no record in the ratifying debates or in the Philadelphia Conventions of talking about protecting corporations the way individuals are protected. But it didn't take long for the issue to arise. By the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations arose in 1809, so just a few decades after the founding of the country. And that's, by the way, about a half century before the first Supreme Court cases on the rights of African Americans or women.
This is a really interesting case. It pits Alexander Hamilton against Thomas Jefferson over the fate of a bank. Could you kind of like lay out the facts of the case and what was being litigated?
Well, as any of your listeners who are fans of the musical Hamilton know, one of the big issues in the founding era that divided the founders was the Bank of the United States, a federal bank that would serve to hold the federal government's deposits and be a source of stability for the economy. And Hamilton was a big backer of the bank, and Jefferson and the Jeffersonians and Madison all opposed the bank. The bank gets adopted, and indeed the bank is famous for giving rise to this two-party system as Jefferson and Hamilton split over the bank's issues. And the bank ends up becoming, at the time, gets enacted and becomes the most powerful and richest corporation in America. At a time when corporations are really local affairs, the bank has branches from Boston to New Orleans. Jeffersonians try to put the bank out of business, a little bit like opponents of Obamacare today. They're determined to kill it by any means necessary. And in Georgia, they pass a tax and impose it on the bank. And the bank tries to challenge that tax in federal court. And the issue that the case raises is whether a business corporation has a right under Article 3 of the Constitution to sue in federal court when it sues someone from another state. Because there is this provision that provides citizens the right to sue in federal court rather than state court if they're suing a citizen of another state. And even though the constitutional provision referred to citizens, the Bank of the United States said it was protected too, and the Supreme Court ultimately agreed. Even though the Supreme Court would be very reluctant to expand the rights of women and minorities and LGBT people for many, many, many decades, it didn't take long for the Supreme Court to begin expanding the rights of corporations.
The legal argument comes down to a question of whether the corporation is an entity on its own terms that has its own rights, or whether its rights are derivative of the association of investors it represents. And the way that plays out in court is kind of counterintuitive today. There is a kind of facile argument in left-wing circles that there is something wrong with corporations being considered legal persons. But at the time, in that legal context, treating the corporation as a legal person would have left it more restricted in its ability to operate under law.
One of the things I found in my research on the history of these corporate rights cases in the Supreme Court is that our ideas of corporate personhood are pretty not grounded in how the Supreme Court has approached the question. The idea of corporate personhood is very controversial these days, but it's really an old established legal principle. You go back to 1757, Blackstone, in his influential commentaries on the laws of England, describes corporations as artificial persons. And all that means in corporate law, and this is a very sort of basic principle of corporate law that every law student learns, is that a corporation is its own independent entity in the eyes of the law, with its own rights and its own duties. And that's why, for instance, if you slip and fall at Starbucks, you have to sue Starbucks, the corporation. You can't sue the individual stakeholders, the individual shareholders, or the employees, because those are separate legal persons with separate rights and separate duties. So corporate personhood is actually an essential idea for holding corporations liable for crimes and for wrongs. And many people blame corporate personhood for the expansion of constitutional rights. But while the Supreme Court has occasionally said corporations are people under the Constitution, in general, what the court has said is what it said in that 1809 case, that corporations have rights because their members have rights. And so the court in that 1809 case didn't say that corporations are citizens. It said instead that the members of the corporation are citizens. And so the corporation has the right to use those members' rights and claim the benefit and protection of the members' rights. And I think that's the reason why corporations have such expansive rights, because the members are all people. And if you base the rights of corporations on the rights of the members rather than treating the corporation as its own independent legal entity, then the rights of corporations will be quite expansive.
Which is essentially the same legal reasoning that leads to the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case extending religious freedoms to corporations. They make an argument that the religious beliefs of the owners are the religious beliefs of the corporation. The court has to pierce the corporate veil in order to expand corporate rights.
That's right, even though I'm sure the owners of Hobby Lobby, the Green family, would insist on corporate personhood and the protection for shareholders should someone slip and fall in a Hobby Lobby store today. They would say, no, no, corporation and us, we're separate legal persons with separate rights and separate duties. But in Hobby Lobby, they impose their religious beliefs on the corporation, and the Supreme Court accepts that idea. Indeed, it's a real through line throughout the Supreme Court case law. One of the surprising things I found is that there were a couple of instances over the Supreme Court's history where the court really did treat the corporation as a person, as its own independent entity with its own legal rights, separate from the rights of its members. And generally in those cases, the court has restricted the rights of corporations or limited them in a way that's less, so that they have less rights, fewer rights than individuals. So corporate personhood has actually played an unusual role. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
In when Teddy Roosevelt tried to break up the trusts in the early 1900s, they subpoenaed the officers of the tobacco companies to testify against the companies before the grand jury. The company said, hey, this violates our Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination to have our own officers testify against us. The Supreme Court said, no, that's not self-incrimination because the people who work for the corporation and the corporation itself are separate legal entities with separate legal rights. And so it wasn't self-incrimination for the officers to testify. So that's an example where corporations have fewer rights than individuals, in part because the court recognizes that they're treated as their own independent entity. And so, surprisingly, personhood could be used to limit sensibly the rights of corporations.
So I guess this gets to my first big takeaway from the book, which is that if you are concerned with the steady expansion of corporate power in America, challenging the legal concept of corporate personhood is not necessarily the right place to target your fire.
That's right. I think that targeting corporate personhood is a mistake because that's not the linchpin to corporate constitutional rights that people think it is.
What is?
Well, what it really is this kind of idea that a corporation is a pass-through. As I said, in 1809, the Supreme Court said that a corporation can take the protection of citizens because their members were citizens. And in Hobby Lobby, the court says that the corporation has religious liberty rights because the birth control requirement burdens the religious liberty of the Green family, the owners. That kind of piercing the veil approach has really led to the expansion of corporate constitutional rights. And where the court has adopted the idea of corporate personhood, genuinely treating a corporation as its own legal entity with its own rights and own privileges, the courts generally recognize that corporations have more limited rights. One thing I think it's clear is that corporations need some protections against rights. Let's face it, the New York Times is a corporation, and if it doesn't have protection against censorship in Donald Trump's America, we could be in trouble.
We're speaking to Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at UCLA, just out with a new book, We the Corporations, How American Business Won Their Civil Rights. I want to step forward a little bit to the post-Civil War era. The constitutional reforms that came out of the Civil War, most notably the 14th Amendment, which was key to abolishing slavery, surprisingly, are not really litigated for the benefit of former slaves. Most of the cases that go to trial under that constitutional amendment are about corporate personhood and corporate rights.
That's right. It's one of the most remarkable stories in the history of American constitutional law, I think, which is how corporations won rights under the 14th Amendment. That a provision was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves. But the court didn't really read any substantive protections for African Americans into that provision for almost three quarters of a century. Meanwhile, in the 1880s, corporations led by the Southern Pacific Railroad Company fought a remarkable series of what the lawyers called test cases to win 14th Amendment rights for business. Of these 60 test cases run by the Southern Pacific Railroad and Leland Stanford, two of them made it to the Supreme Court, each one more bizarre than the next. In the first, the Southern Pacific Railroad's lawyer, an illustrious lawyer by the name of Roscoe Conkling, who had been a leader in Congress for about 15, 20 years, and had even been nominated and confirmed to sit on the Supreme Court himself, turning down the post and becoming the last person ever to turn down a Supreme Court seat after having won confirmation in the Senate. Conkling, it turns out, was just making too much money as a lawyer for the railroads.
You said, no, and, I'll pass on that Supreme Court seat. I'd like real power.
But Conkling went to the Supreme Court, so he had a lot of credibility when he went before the justices because he was basically one himself. And he told the justices that the 14th Amendment was also drafted and written to protect the rights of business corporations. It was an audacious argument, but Conkling had once been, when he was a young congressman, had been on the drafting committee that had written the 14th Amendment. So he was testifying to his own original intent of the framers because he was one of the drafters. And it turns out that years later, historians have gone back and looked at his argument for the Supreme Court and the evidence that he produced, including a musty old journal that he claimed was a never-before-published record of the deliberations of the 14th Amendment Drafting Committee. And historians have gone back and found that while his journal was indeed a never-before-published record of the Drafting Committee's records and deliberations, it didn't support his argument. And historians have concluded that Conkling engaged in what one called a, quote, brazen, deliberate forgery to win new rights for corporations.
He lied to the court.
That he basically lied to the court. And I believe that the court found this out and discovered this at the time because they held on to his case, didn't rule on it for 3 years. And then the case was just settled, surprisingly. And then another one of the Southern Pacific 60 test cases comes up to the Supreme Court the next year. And the court rules in that case in favor of the Southern Pacific Railroad, although it doesn't rule on the constitutional question, doesn't say anything about whether corporations have constitutional rights. It says we're not going to decide that question. Yet the reporter of decisions, the person who's responsible for publishing the Supreme Court's opinions officially, traditionally includes a summary of the opinion before it in the published volumes. And the reporter of decisions in this case included a summary that said that the court had indeed held that corporations were protected by the 14th Amendment. And that incorrect summary gets picked up by a colorful justice, Stephen Field, a few years later, who the first justice from California and the only justice ever to be arrested for a crime while he was on the Supreme Court. And the charge was, by the way, murder. So he was a colorful guy. It turns out that, so a couple years later, he decides to drop a citation in a case saying, well, we held in the Southern Pacific Railroad that corporations had rights too. And ever since then, the Supreme Court has held that corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment. And at root was a case that did not even hold that principle.
They invented a precedent to create a precedent.
They invented a precedent to create a precedent. And in the years to come, the Supreme Court would rule on only 28 14th Amendment cases involving African Americans by 1912. And in that same time, the court would rule on 312 14th Amendment cases on the rights of business corporations.
So one lesson I drew from this, Roscoe Conkling sounds not just audacious, but kind of brilliant as a lawyer. Clearly, Southern Pacific Railroad can afford the best. They can afford the only person left alive who was in the room when the 14th Amendment got drafted. Knowing he can bend the truth without having anyone call BS on him, it seems like one of the takeaways there is what's in the Constitution, what's in the law is all fine and good, but over time, it becomes whatever the party with the best lawyers wants it to be.
There is a story of 200 years of very audacious lawyering. And I think one of the secrets for the success of corporations in winning constitutional rights is that they've always been able to afford the best, most creative lawyers in America and fight risky lawsuit after risky lawsuit after risky lawsuit, where even if they lose, it's just part of the cost of doing business. And if they win, the profits can be huge. And so we think about, you know, lawyers have played a starring role in all the great civil rights movements from Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But those organizations relied on volunteer lawyers, whereas corporations way back in the day were hiring the likes of Daniel Webster, considered one of the greatest Supreme Court advocates in history, who argued more than 220 cases in the Supreme Court, many on behalf of business corporations. They've always been able to afford the best lawyers. And that continues to this day. There's an elite Supreme Court bar that really privileges corporations over individuals and public interest groups even to this day.
And also willing to adapt their legal agenda to more plausibly popular causes. The first test on segregation, Plessy versus Ferguson, is a case that was engineered by a railroad company that didn't want to go to the expense of running multiple cars to accommodate two different races of passengers.
That's right. One of the things that I find surprising in the history of these corporate rights cases is that corporations have been unexpected innovators in a variety of ways in the Constitution. So corporations were involved because they had these resources in many of the early and most influential cases on a whole wide range of constitutional doctrines that would later be used for the benefit of individuals. From the early 19th century, it was things like the contract clause, when the Supreme Court was still not reading the equal protection and due process clauses to provide much protection for African Americans, they read them broadly to protect rights for corporations. And corporations were behind some of the earliest Fourth Amendment cases on the rights against unreasonable searches and seizures when government tried to inspect business records. And corporations were behind some of the earliest successful First Amendment cases in the 1930s. Newspaper corporations were challenging censorship, like when Huey Long tried to censor the Louisiana newspaper corporations. And corporations have really been at the forefront of many of our constitutional rights, which was kind of a surprising and somewhat disturbing part of the story that I found, I thought.
Yeah, so this is another inflection point. Up until the period you're describing, the rights that corporations had been able to secure in the courts were property rights. When they start asserting a constitutional First Amendment right against censorship as newspaper corporations, for the first time, they're asserting what you call liberatory rights. It seems like everything starts with the First Amendment these days, when corporations are trying to assert some power against government regulation. That seems like it's where it really starts.
Indeed. You know, one traditional limit on the rights of corporations was divide between property rights and liberty rights. Corporations had property rights, but the Supreme Court said often they don't have liberty rights, those rights that are associated with personal conscience or political freedom or bodily integrity. And in fact, 100 years ago, the courts rejected corporations' efforts to overturn campaign finance laws a century before Citizens United, saying that that's not the kind of right that a corporation had. A century before, in 1907, more than a century before this term's Masterpiece Cake Shop case on whether a Colorado baker can refuse to provide services to a same-sex couple, the Supreme Court held that corporations did not have a constitutional right to refuse service to unwanted customers. That really breaks down in the 1930s, beginning with newspaper corporations winning First Amendment rights of freedom of the press, which is the first liberty right that's really extended to corporations. And that property-liberty distinction falls away, and today corporations have many of those fundamental liberty rights, including political freedom after Citizens United and religious liberty, at least under a federal statute in the Hobby Lobby case, and maybe greater First Amendment freedoms after this Masterpiece Cake Shop case.
So if we fast forward to the Citizens United decision in 2010, the major legal innovation here is not that corporations are people. It's not that corporations have free speech rights. It's that spending to influence campaigns is equated with free speech.
Well, I think that is a big part of the issue. So when we think about Citizens United and the effect that it's had, it's not only unleashed new corporate money into the system, but even more so, a lot of individual spending. And so Citizens United did more than just release corporations from restrictions on spending, but many other spenders as well, and is thus responsible for more problems in the political system than just the rights of corporations. But there is a lot of dark money, and one of the things we're seeing is that corporations are being more active in using those rights at the state and local level, both in terms of spending, using those. We expect corporations to spend a lot of money in presidential elections, but that's a place where there's all such an inundation of money already that corporations can't make a big impact. But on local zoning decisions by local county commissions, that's the kind of place where you can expect corporations like Walmart to have a big impact. And I expect to see much more corporate spending in the near future.
I mean, what you're describing, the long arc of this book, is a slow but steady and relentless process of changing the law to favor corporations that never happens publicly. It's not debated in Congress. It's not subjected to any kind of pressures in the realm of political opinion. It's a series of incremental cases that are waged in the courts that are capable of reversing the court's position from one decade to another.
No, that's right. And it is a story. And that's why I kind of compare it to this, the civil rights movement. You know, obviously, corporations are not like women and minorities. They've never been subjugated and oppressed the way women and minorities have. And they didn't risk their lives to gain constitutional rights the way women and minorities did and have. So there's no moral equivalency between these two ideas. But rather, I wanted to use that idea of a civil rights movement to capture two ideas. One, to offset and to sort of highlight how corporations have often been benefited by the Supreme Court. At the same time, it's denying rights to women and to minorities. And that kind of comparison is kind of shocking. But also, there is this sense of relentlessness that it starts very early on in American history, and it just pursues corporations pursue this litigation year after year after year. And there is a sense in which corporations are unified over time to try to seek these rights. And they don't march in the street claiming rights. But corporations know that you can win rights in the courts. And we think about social movements as being really important ways in which we change society, and that part of the essential key of social movements is this public advocacy and persuading people and changing people's hearts and minds. Corporations long ago realized you just need to win in court and change hearts and minds later.
Yeah. So corporations have had speech rights. Corporations have had property rights since the early 19th century. They've had speech rights since that case you referenced in the 1930s. Those speech rights have extended to spending to influence campaigns since Citizens United. They've had religious rights since Hobby Lobby just a few years ago. What's the next frontier? What are the cases expanding corporate rights that are going to be brought in front of the people Donald Trump is putting on the bench right now?
Well, of course, this term, there's a very, very important corporate rights case before the Supreme Court. It's not being framed in those terms, but it is. It's this Masterpiece Cake Shop case involving this Colorado baker who refused to sell a cake to a same-sex couple. And if the Supreme Court sides with the baker, it will basically say that corporations, businesses like his bakery, Masterpiece Cake Shop, which is the name of the entity that is behind the lawsuit, that those entities can discriminate against LGBT customers, even if the law says they cannot discriminate. And that would really create a huge loophole in our civil rights laws that I think would be really devastating. It's really interesting. In the oral argument in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, all the lawyers there, no matter what their position on this issue, all agreed that a baker would not have a right to discriminate on the basis of race. And but that doesn't, you know, back in the 1960s, corporations brought those cases arguing that they had constitutional right to discriminate on the basis of race and that the Constitution protected them against these civil rights laws. The courts back then ruled almost universally against those businesses. And the reason why it's unthinkable you can discriminate on the basis of race today if you're a business is because the courts said back then you don't have a constitutional right to discriminate. Let's hope it's not a lesson the Supreme Court today forgets in the lesson let's hope that's not a lesson the Supreme Court today forgets in the context of LGBTQ rights.
Well, let's flip it around. I mentioned corporate accountability activists. And you referenced towards the end of your book some of the rallying cries that came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. One is calling for constitutional amendments to end corporate personhood and to end the treatment of money as speech. A lot of your argument amounts to the sentiment is right, the fire is aimed at the wrong place. What would a movement to productively curtail the political power that is exerted by corporations at the expense of individual people's well-being and civil liberties, what would a movement productively organize around?
Well, it's a great point, and I totally sympathize and agree with the political sentiment that says corporations have way too much power, that Citizens United is a mistake and should be overturned, and that if necessary, a constitutional amendment is the way to do that. I support that idea. What I disagree with is the idea that we should have a constitutional amendment like that's been proposed by some organizations, saying that corporations are not people and have no rights under the Constitution. I just think that's the wrong way to think about this issue. Corporations, if they don't have property rights, then the government can come seize Google's campus, build a highway through there, and not pay a dime of just compensation. that's not right. That can't be the right answer. If corporations have no due process rights, then Apple has no right to fight against the FBI the next time the FBI wants it to open up an iPhone. It's only the right, the fact that Apple has a due process right, that it can fight against the FBI. If corporations have no rights, then the New York Times and CNN would both be easily subject to Donald Trump's censorship. So I just don't think that's the right answer. I think corporations need some rights, but the answer is a nuanced one. Corporations need some property rights, but probably don't need the kinds of liberty rights that the court has in recent years extended to corporations. And, you know, that kind of nuance is not the kind of rallying cry that gets people in the streets to amend the Constitution, that corporations should have some rights but not all rights. But honestly, I think that's the way to think about the problem. And a blunderbuss approach that takes all rights away from corporations, I think, is just a step further than most people who support such an amendment really want to go.
Well, Adam Winkler, it gave me a lot to think about, and you get extra credit for working the word blunderbuss into your interview. Thank you so much for coming in.
What a pleasure to be here.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA, just out with We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And a quick footnote to that interview, for those of you who are listening closely, we recorded it before the end of the current Supreme Court session and before the case he most recently referenced, Masterpiece Cake Shop, was decided. That did, in fact, come down on the side of the cake baker who did not want to serve a same-sex couple who was getting married. It was decided on narrow procedural grounds and kicked back down to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. The majority opinion of that case was written by soon-to-retire Justice Anthony Kennedy.